Welcome to this episode of the Global Innovators in Business series. In this series, we bring in leaders and innovators from different fields to share their advice and experiences with undergraduate students to provide inspiration and motivation during the pandemic. We're so happy to have with us Matthew Banik. Matt is a former managing partner of the Omidyar Network, where he led all aspects of operations and strategy. Under his leadership, the Omidyar Network invested more than $1.2 billion in for-profit social ventures, impacting tens of millions of lives and also transforming the impact investing sector. Matt has also been the previous president of eBay International and the president of PayPal. Finally, Matt is now the professor at Stanford Graduate School of Business. This full interview is dedicated to BRAC. Their mission is to empower people and communities in situations of poverty, literacy, disease, and social injustice. BRAC has been a leader in poverty reduction efforts through social and economic empowerment, both in Bangladesh and around the world. Learn more with a link in the description. So thank you so much, Matt.
You're welcome. Delighted to be here, Christopher. Thank you.
Matt, I know you have worked with countless social ventures and nonprofits. Why did you choose to dedicate this interview to BRAC?
Yeah, BRAC is perhaps the singularly most impressive NGO that I've encountered in my years in the social enterprise world. Some of the things I love about them is they're committed to disadvantaged populations. Most of their work is in Bangladesh, where they support in some way or another more than 120 million people through healthcare and financial inclusion and education. And they've extended their model to other countries as well. Importantly, they're mostly self-sustaining, so they have social businesses that generate revenue that support a lot of their other activities. Mm-hmm. And they openly share their knowledge with others throughout the world so they can expand their impact even further. Mm-hmm. And the reason they've come to my mind this week is it's the one-year anniversary of the passing of the founder of BRAC, Sir Fazel Abed. And just as BRAC is perhaps the singularly most impressive NGO that I've got to know in my work in the social sector, Sir Fazel was perhaps the singularly most impressive leader in the social sector that I had an opportunity to meet. He started BRAC after the cyclone in Bangladesh in the early 70s and their war for independence. He left a cush job in London to come back to his native Bangladesh and to build this extraordinary organization. And he did it with such grace and humility. So I'll never forget, when we visited BRAC in Dhaka years ago, I went to a slum where they were doing some microfinance work and some maternal health work. And then we were gonna go afterwards and see BRAC and meet Sir Fazel. As we got from this peninsula across some water and got back to the van, I thought, okay, I asked how far away is the BRAC headquarters? And they said, no, it's right here. And we got up to Sir Fazel's conference room and it was overlooking the slum. And he said, we must never forget who we work for, right? And the guy embodied what I call the three C's of leadership, highly competent, built this extraordinary organization, so the first C. Second C is his character, a man of the utmost honesty and integrity and forthrightness. Mm-hmm. And the third C is really compassion. He had incredible compassion, a big heart for the underserved. So he's just one of my heroes, and the organization is amazing. And I just felt it was appropriate to give him a nod on this day, which is the anniversary of his passing.
Wow. I'm so glad we can dedicate this interview to BRAC. And these are the people who you work with every day. We will get to the Omidyar Network very soon, but tell us your backstory. What brought you to today?
Yeah, it's a great question. So for context, I'm the 12th of 13 children from a big Catholic family just outside of Seattle. And so I knew that I had to both, quote, follow my dream. That's what everybody's told. But I also had to be somewhat pragmatic about it. Mm-hmm. So much of my career is this sort of multiple points of intersection between, you know, pragmatism and idealism, or following my passion and then understanding what is possible in a given context. Mm-hmm. And so when I was undergrad, for example, my first love was international studies and global affairs. But I also realized that there aren't too many jobs for liberal arts majors in international studies, unless you wanted to become a diplomat, but that was like a foreign service exam, 1 out of 80 pass it, that's unlikely. So I said, okay, I'm gonna study something that I can get a job. And I couldn't study business because that would have been an extra year. So I studied economics, so I had international studies and economics. And then as I emerged from undergraduate, I was able to get a job in banking back in New York, which was a very, again, pragmatic choice because banking prepares you for business more generally and makes your, gives you relevant experience for a broad set of industries. But I also took the foreign service exam when I was a senior in college, and I passed. Mm-hmm. And I realized at that stage that I wanted to try both, you know, dabble in the private sector, try my hand as a diplomat, and then go from there and maybe go back to business school. So I actually took the GMAT my senior year in college as well. And I had a fellowship after my senior year. And this fellowship after my senior year, I worked for Nomura Securities in Japan. And it was when I was was at Nomura, I was at a meeting where there was a Professor Collier Crum from Harvard Business School was there. And I was thinking ahead and I said, oh, I should talk to Professor Crum. And I said, I'd love to think about Harvard Business School one day. He said, okay, when you get to New York, look me up. Right. So then how this unfolded is I said, okay, if I'm gonna try diplomacy in banking, it's much easier to go from the private sector into diplomacy because you'll be accepted. But once you go into the public sector, it's harder to get a job in the private sector. There's not as much respect for those kinds of roles. So I said, okay, here's my 5-year plan. Couple years in banking, right? Couple years in diplomacy, have an option to go back to business school. So I had that already in mind. Banking, went back to New York, got to New York. My first day in New York, by the way, I was down on Wall Street. Mayhem was breaking out. It was Black Monday in 1987. Mm-hmm. Had a couple terrific years doing primarily middle market leverage buyouts for Chemical Bank. Mm-hmm. And then decided it was time to go to exercise the option to go to the Foreign Service. Mm-hmm. So I joined the US Foreign Service, State Department as a diplomat. And they sent me off. Oh, before that, okay. Before that, I found out that I got into Harvard Business School, but on a deferred basis, coming back to Collier Crum. When I got back to New York, called him up, we went to breakfast, he grilled me for 3 hours. And that was sort of, I think, my admissions interview for HBS. I first got the note saying they deferred me a year. Yeah. And then I got a note from him saying, hey, hope you're not too disappointed about the year deferral. I think you could benefit from another year of experience.
Yes.
That's then when I went to the State Department. I deferred HBS for a year, so I could do a stint as a diplomat.
Where did the Foreign Service send you to?
Yeah, they sent me to Germany because I'd studied German undergrad. And I got to Germany the day the Berlin Wall came down. So I was feeling rather fortunate to be in these pretty phenomenal moments in history, both with the Black Monday and then with the fall of the Berlin Wall. I had an amazing couple of years as a diplomat in Germany. But I decided for a whole host of reasons to go back to business school. In part, I noticed the bureaucracy would be a little stifling for me. And I wasn't convinced I wanted to spend 2/3 of my life overseas. So at that point, I exercised the option to go back to business school. Between my first and second years of business school, I was a summer associate with McKinsey, a management consulting firm in Brussels. And I had an offer to join them full-time after business school in their German office. Mm-hmm. At that time, however, my father's health was ailing, so I wanted to get back to the West Coast. And the closest McKinsey office to my hometown of Seattle was San Francisco. So I joined the McKinsey San Francisco office. And the reason I did consulting was one of the considerations I had a lot in my career was, how do I create more optionality? When you're younger in your career, it's about gaining skills, banking, diplomacy, whatnot, and broadening your knowledge base and your skill base, so then later you can firmly step in one direction, but with a broad base, right? So I went to consulting in part because I thought it would continue to broaden my base in the knowledge of business and would be suitable for a whole host of roles thereafter. I knew going in that I was unlikely to be consulting, but I thought it would be quite beneficial.
And I think if I remember correctly, at this point, you chose to leave McKinsey for a much smaller tech company.
Yeah, I joined this mapping company called Navtech, Navigation Technologies. It was later bought by Nokia and then by Microsoft, and was kind of ahead of its time from a technology perspective. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, Christopher, at this stage in my career, so I had been a banker, a diplomat, a consultant, and now as an aligned business, I hadn't really found my calling. I felt I could do each of these jobs pretty well, but none of these jobs I feel was like the right fit for me, or was I utilizing my innermost passions, the things I was most interested in, and my skill set. When I was at NABTECH, I went from being the head of strategy suddenly because of management turnover, to running the North American division of NABTECH, which was about 300 people. So I went from having never managed a person in my life mm-hmm. to suddenly managing 300 people mm-hmm. across 27 field offices in the US, and at the age of 30. And I served as president of NABTECH for 5 or 6 years. NABTECH North America, that is. They were moving back to Chicago, and I love Chicago, but I wanted to stay in the Bay Area. I mean, I had 3 kids at the time, wanted to stay in the Bay Area. So here's where serendipity comes in, because I like to talk of planful serendipity, right? It sounds like an oxymoron, but you have a plan, but you're also ready to pivot when you see the right opportunities emerge. So, and some of this stuff just happens. It just happens. Mm-hmm. And so one day, I love maps. And one day I was looking for a map of Northern Germany from the town where my grandfather, great-grandfather immigrated in 1871. And I asked one of our geographers, because NABTECH was full of these geographers, what's the best map store in San Francisco? Mm-hmm. And he said, don't go to a map store. If it's broad-based inventory you're looking for, go to this thing called eBay. This was like 1998. I said, eBay? I said, yeah, www.ebay.com. And I'm like, okay, I'll try out this thing called eBay. It was a very early stage of the internet. Mm-hmm. So I went on eBay and I'm like, oh my God, not only did I see more maps than I ever could have imagined, I'm like, what an amazing business model. You know, no inventories, no accounts receivable, you know, and it's basically a commission business. And because the technology, it can scale infinitely. You got network effects. And oh my gosh, they're just down the road in San Jose. So through some working my network a little bit, I was able to join eBay. I joined eBay as employee number 140. Mm-hmm. So at a time when you joined eBay where they put a PowerPoint slide up where you say, okay, Matt's joining. Here's a little bit about Matt. It's a tiny company, mm-hmm. which is another lesson, which is you really want to go where the growth is. You know, if you look for professional opportunities, I think I would have done reasonably well in my career in a whole host of circumstances. But if I had joined a manufacturing company that was growing at 5% a year, I would never have had the opportunities I had when I joined eBay as employee number 140. Because I was able to demonstrate what I could do, but also because the growth was so extraordinary that we need Meg Whitman, who was the CEO when I was there, we needed talent, trusted talent to put into different circumstances. So that's when I got the opportunity to run eBay International. And then when we bought PayPal, Meg asked me to go over and be the first post-acquisition president of PayPal, chief executive at PayPal. And then it's interesting because, again, a moment in time, we had, I turned 40 when I was running PayPal. We had a big eBay board meeting in Berlin. And Germany had great meaning for me because I'd studied there. I'd been a diplomat there. My ancestors were from Germany. And things are going so well. But I also started thinking, are there other things I could do with my life? You know, it's funny because sometimes when you reach more than, frankly, you thought you could reach, you still start, okay, what else is out there? What else is out there? One of the things I really loved about eBay is I felt like we were delivering huge value to society because we were creating a platform where millions of people mm-hmm. could build their livelihoods. And in fact, you had segments of the population, such as single moms, mm-hmm. who in particularly found new opportunities because they could work at home, build a fabulous business, and still be with their child or children. Yeah. So I felt that eBay, we were generating great social good. Mm-hmm. And I also recognize that ultimately it was about earnings per share. Ultimately, it was about financial returns was the metric we looked at for success. Around this time, I began to talk about Piero Medeiros, who was the founder of eBay and who I knew from working with the eBay board. And Pierre had said, you know, he'd already publicly committed that he was going to commit 90% of his resources to the betterment of humankind in his lifetime. It was before this Gates Giving Pledge, unusual for somebody to make such a bold proclamation about how they're going to commit their assets. Mm-hmm. But what Pierre realized is he'd start out with a traditional giving approach where he just gave money to well-intentioned not-for-profits. Mm-hmm. And he said, hold on, is that the only way to have social impact? You know, here it is, I had huge social impact creating this business called eBay. Why is it that when we think about creating impact, when we think about philanthropy, which generally means love of humankind, mm-hmm. why when we think about doing good, we think we can only give money away? So Pierre then began to create a separate structure within his family office, so to speak, mm-hmm. where he created this thing called the Midyar Network, which had both a grant-making organization or grant-making capability for not-for-profits, and also an investment capability. So a limited liability corporation and a 501c3. Yeah. And so we had the ability to figure out, okay, what is it the issue? What are the issues we care about, such as education or financial inclusion or technology for good? And then in this situation, what's the best tool to use? Is it a for-profit investment or is it a not-for-profit grant? Because mm-hmm. the advantage you have when you make an investment is you can scale infinitely. If you generate the profit, you can scale the operation by using those profits to scale and also tapping the commercial capital markets.
There's so many parts of that that is very incredible. How do they trust a 30-year-old person who was in the job for about 6 months to lead the company? What did he do in that 6 months to impress them enough that they were willing to put you in charge?
Well, I guess you'll have to ask my former boss, Russ Shields. But I remember when Russ, so a couple of funny stories there. The way I found out I was going to lead the organization, we were at a management leadership offsite. There were about 20 people who led our global organization. Mm-hmm. And everybody at the end of this couple day offsite was asked to say something to the group about the reflections the last couple of days. And as it was going around and people were saying different things, I got a little note from Russ. And the note from Russ said, Matt, I'm now making you president of NAVTECH North America. When it gets around to you, please say something profound. So this is how I found out, oh my gosh, okay, I'm gonna be leading this organization of 300 people. Now I have to say something profound. I probably said something rather silly, but the first week on the job there, Russ was in the office every day. And then when he left, I suddenly felt, okay, you know, what do I do, right? I literally said, Russ, well, what do I do now? Do I call a meeting? You know, what do I do? And Russ turned to me, and he was going to Japan for 2-3 weeks by intent, I think. So he would just have me find my sea leg, so to speak. But I said, what do I do? And I turned to Russ, and Russ says, look, Matt, you're smart and people like you. You'll figure it out. And you know, how many tomes on leadership are there? How many books, how many volumes have been written about leadership? And Russ in some ways distilled it down, right? Are you smart? Can you figure it out intellectually? And do people like you? Meaning, can you connect with people? Can you build trust? Can you collaborate effectively? Will they rally behind a set of ideas that you put forward and a strategy? And I guess Russ saw the potential in me, and then credit to him, he gave me the opportunity to step up and demonstrate what I could do.
So interesting. And going back even further to your days as a diplomat, do you think there is one lesson that as a diplomat you learned that you continue to leverage or to heed as you went on to lead eBay International and Midyar Network?
Gosh, you know, I think it's almost, yes, but there are so many lessons, Christopher. I learned a lot about geopolitics. I learned a lot more about Europe. I've learned a lot of specific things about Germany, my language, and all those things. But I relearned or reinforced a set of lessons that I had taken away from studying in Germany, and that also been reinforced in my entire career and my work internationally, is that we as human beings have a lot more in common than we have differences, and that there are fundamental human values that we share at some level. You know, there are lenses of culture and tradition and spirituality and ethnicity and all these other different lenses that people sort through and how they process things. But, you know, at the end of the day, most people are looking for similar things, and most people are basically good. I still fundamentally believe that was a fundamental tenet of eBay. And it sounds kind of sometimes rather naive American way of looking at the world, but my experience is it's genuinely true, and that people want to work with people who they can trust and who they believe are not only competent, but caring individuals. And so a lot of those lessons are ones that have just, those are the most significant ones in my view, ones that have continued to be reinforced in my work, both in the private sector and in the social sector and in the academic world as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I lived half my life in Beijing, China, and coming into the United States, there's so much division across the world, but we all breathe the same air. We all have tears. We all experience the same kind of emotions. There's so much that connects us that we often neglect.
Yeah, and it starts with a quest for understanding the other person. You still, at the end of trying to understand that person, you still may completely disagree, right? But at least you've taken the time and the effort and developed an understanding and a connection that you otherwise would not have.
And how did you leverage these lessons in eBay International? Like, how did you bring eBay to other countries, and how did you leverage this ability for everybody to see this thing the same way into bringing eBay to a new country and making them see that perspective of how amazing eBay can be?
So the beauty of eBay, and I can contrast this with PayPal and taking PayPal internationally if you want, but the beauty of eBay is 90% of it was user-generated content. Mm-hmm. When you think about the core of eBay is the listings that the sellers put up, mm-hmm. right? That's the core. And all you need to do in some sense, not to make my job sound too easy, but you needed to localize the language and like the core pages on the website. But then it was populated by locals, right? And so it inherently had that local feel. And the desire to trade and buy and sell, that's universal. Mm-hmm. Different cultural dynamics were captured in the different local communities and in different ways. The same fundamental concept, but different ways. So even as we have some core similarities, things are expressed in a different way. So I remember one of my first focus group tours I did in Europe. We had a focus group lunch in Berlin, and then followed the next day a focus group lunch in Rome. And in both places, one of the topics of significant conversation was feedback. Mm-hmm. Right? And one of the specific elements of feedback was getting a negative feedback. And how did that feel? And with the German group, they would say, yes, the feedback, I was upset, it made me angry, and this is how I dealt. In Rome, first of all, there's a little more wine flowing, and there were gestures, and there was a lot of emotion. And so some of those things are, it's the same issue, right? Mm-hmm. And both cultures care about that issue so deeply. Mm-hmm. And then how they relate to it and express it is different. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the tricks when, so for eBay, localization was easy on the product, but understanding the dynamics of some of the interlocutors that you would deal with in building a business country by country, that was different. And just things like, and again, from your cross-cultural experience, how far away you stand from a person when you're at a cocktail party. Mm-hmm. Germans are a little closer together. And I was bemused a few times at cocktail parties when I was a diplomat, how the German and the American would be talking, and then after a half hour, if they're still in conversation, they've moved, shifted this way, because each is shifting to a comfort zone. And so working on the global scene takes a lot of humility, I think. And humility is an interesting, humility doesn't mean meekness in my mind. C.S. Lewis, the great author, said, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. In other words, thinking of the other person more. Right? So to be successful, I think, in an international context, you've got to pay attention. You've got to have the humility and the interest in the other person to pick up a whole host of subtle cues. Because if you ignore them, you can make somebody uncomfortable or not trust you. So that's like empathy is just absolutely critical in it.
What is like one example that eBay adopted from understanding that somehow changed the way that eBay approached something?
Yeah, then we get to a different cultural norm. So a lot of what we grew internationally is through acquisition, including a company in Korea. In Korea, the level of trust of a complete stranger was lower than in the US. Mm-hmm. That leads to a different business model. In the case of Korea, there was a built-in escrow service. Mm-hmm. And so that's a specific adaptation for the Korean market. Mm-hmm. By the way, PayPal was again a different animal, because PayPal, the payment infrastructure and payment methods that people prefer varies country by country. So PayPal, we had to adopt country by country. We had to create a separate platform, really. Whereas eBay, you rolled out pretty much the same platform in most countries with some tweaks, such as this functionality for Korea. And then in some markets, what's fascinating to me, we took an equity stake in Mercado Libre, which is now the e-commerce giant in Latin America. And Mercado Libre, because e-commerce was a smaller market when they started in Latin America, they're not only the leading, quote, auction player, they're the leading e-commerce player, they're leading payments player, they're leading logistics player. So because the market was more nascent when they got in, they can play a much broader role. But now I'm geeking out on some of the business stuff. So I apologize for taking us in that direction.
Very interesting.
I'll share another example with you. And this is from my Omidyar Network days. We did 2/3 of our investing at Omidyar Network in emerging and frontier markets. And we worked a lot with lower income populations. One of the visits that had the most impact on me was when I made a visit to India with Pierak. Omidyar was actually with us for that visit. And we went to the state of Andhra Pradesh, went to a poor rural community where we were supporting an organization that enabled landless women who for generations had been working the land but didn't own it. We enabled them to actually buy the land. So suddenly they're landowners. And so I went in, so we met with a group of them and I asked them, why is this important to you to own your own land? And Christopher, the things that were occurring to me were the economic arguments. Okay, now whatever they harvest is theirs. Now maybe they have an incentive to plant fruit trees because they can own what comes off of the fruit tree, or maybe they'll plant a second season. And so I had all these economic things in my mind. And there's a group of women surrounded around us, and I asked them this question. The woman spoke, and the translation came back. The most important thing I have now is dignity. I can walk tall in the village because I have land. And so what's so interesting to me is that's the thing that was the most meaningful to her, is basic human dignity. And time again, I see that around the world as well. People want to be respected. They want their dignity. Even in the example of feedback and getting upset about feedback, somebody's taken a piece of your dignity when they give you a negative piece of feedback, right? That's a smallish example. But even as we get as an econ major or business people enmeshed in all the economic theory and economic values, remember that there's a few sacred things that every person carries, and dignity is at the center.
That's a great lesson. Yes. And I think that's a perfect gateway. After leaving eBay International, why did he choose to go into this impact investing space at all?
I like stories, Christopher. So I'll share a little story with you. Once I started engaging with Pierre more deeply about how he's thinking about his philanthropy and how he had committed the lion's share of his and his wife's wealth to the betterment of humankind, he engaged me to help him consult with him on how he was going to pull these various things together. And then at some point he said, Matt, I would love you to lead the charge. We're going to commit billions of dollars to this enterprise. And I'm like, I trust you. I've known you for 8 years. I want you to lead the charge. So I did the thing that any good business school student would do. I got out, made a pro-con list with 12 different factors, and each of them had a weighting. And so I did my whole weighted average or weighted decision-making here, and I came to the bottom and was looking at which number was going to be greater, right? Stay at eBay or go to Omidyar Network. Mm-hmm. And the eBay number was higher. So I said, okay, there's my decision. I guess I'm staying at eBay. And then I went to bed that night and I was just uncomfortable. I felt something didn't quite fit. And I woke up in the morning. I said, look, this isn't a weighted average calculation decision. This is a gut check. Here's a guy who has billions of dollars that he wants to commit to the betterment of humankind, and he's asked you to lead the charge. You don't have a choice. If you want to live consistent with your values, you don't have a choice. You have to do this. You have to do this. Regardless of all the factors, you have to do this. You're called to do this. Mm-hmm. And the irony is that sometimes when you realize you don't have a choice, you feel liberated. was like, I knew exactly what it was that I was going to do. And what was really hard about that, Christopher, was in the ensuing months, is so I was, what, at that stage, I was 42. I'd run, built eBay International. I'd run PayPal. People were saying, oh my gosh, look at all the things you could be doing. And Omidyar Network was a bit of a turnaround at the time. And Matt, look at all the things you've been doing, your peak earning years and blah, blah, blah. And you did what? Right, you decided to join a small, kind of struggling not-for-profit. And what I realized is that 95% of the people in the Valley would have seen it that way. And the people who sit right on, this is exactly what you should, are the people who really knew me. And I will also tell you that, and for all those people at business school who are going into investment banking or consulting because everybody else is, or starting a new enterprise because everybody else is, it's so easy to follow the herd. It's really hard to do something countercultural. You really have to have a strong conviction around it. And we can all say it's not that hard, I'm my own person. No, it is hard sometimes, right? Because if everybody else second guessing you, you say, what am I missing here? But what was the best decision I made from a career perspective? I had a great time my 8 years at eBay, but my God, what a blessing, what a gift to be able to work with a guy such as Pierre Omidyar, who was incredibly innovative, who I knew and trusted, who was committing vast resources to the betterment of humankind, and who was doing it in a very innovative way. And at that point, there were very few organizations doing impact, what is now termed impact investing. So Pierre, in one of my earliest conversations, I said, Pierre, what does success look like? And Pierre said, success is actually not the success of any one investment. Success is changing the way people think about philanthropy, changing the way people think about how they can have a positive impact in the world. That's success. So to the extent that our network played a reasonably important role in driving forward the impact investing sector, I think we really contributed to what Pierre wanted to with his vision.
That's so interesting. And going into that, what is impact that you guys defined? What is the impact that you were trying to create?
Really, we framed impact was around opportunity. This notion that you're not going to give somebody something, but you're going to create opportunity for them to tap their innate skills and capabilities to improve the quality of their lives. And if they did that, they would improve the quality of lives of their family, their community, their society, and ultimately the world. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the organizations we supported were about creating opportunities. So one of them, for example, is Bridge Academies, which provides affordable education in high quality, affordable private education and now public education in Africa and India. They started out providing private education, but now they do public-private partnerships in Liberia, in Nigeria. And it's about creating opportunity because intellect and determination is equally spread around the world. But you don't realize, or most people don't realize, that by 2050, half of the school-aged children are going to be in Africa. Half, 50%. By the way, and another probably 20% in India. And if we don't feel a collective sense of responsibility to create opportunity, you know, how well we educate or how well educated the children of Africa become in the next generation is going to have a huge impact on how the world moves and the shape the world ultimately takes and whether it becomes a very prosperous, hopeful, high dignity place or whether it becomes something less appealing. And so that's the kind of organization you get excited about. Or one of the other ones in Africa that was really is terrific is, and for those of us who are concerned on the environment, is D-Light. And D-Light helps provide home solar systems where people now in rural Africa are paying less per day to light their homes with home solar systems than they were paying with noxious kerosene. And that's another incredible story. And in both of those cases, it's not only supporting an individual company, but they're pioneers in a market. So they're creating entire new markets for social change, which is really exciting. So it's impact through opportunity, really, and enabling people to tap their talents and their skills and their motivation.
I actually worked at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation when I was working in China. They have this like huge philosophy in trying to make sure that they're delivering impact through every dollar they spend, that they can help create the most contributions and create the most change in the world. And for example, working on a mosquito net to help one person like not get malaria is so important compared to spending a lot of money in a more developed country. Maybe. How do you think that message mix in the impact investing sector? Is that a consideration?
Absolutely. So I'm now teaching a class at the Stanford Business School around impact measurement in business and social enterprise. Mm-hmm. So it's precisely this topic. And it really depends what you're trying to accomplish, what sector you're in. So if you're working in healthcare, they have a metric called disability adjusted life years. Mm-hmm. So you can say, okay, bed net intervention versus deworming versus this, you know, how much does it cost? And what's the benefit just in terms of disability life years? And then you can go methodically down and pick the highest benefit to cost ratio interventions. In other areas of philanthropy, it's more difficult. How do you measure educational attainment? And test scores are one thing, but test scores have their challenges. What are the other ways you could possibly measure it? And how do you think about measuring education at elementary school versus college versus workforce development? How do you measure impact of workforce development? And can you compare something in workforce development with something in education or in healthcare, right? It's really difficult to find a standard metric. In business, you have the dollar or whatever the local currency is, and you have metrics such as a return on investment. There's no number that somebody has been able to put on a unit of social impact. Some have tried. So we just had a case study last night on TPG Rise, which is a private equity firm that develops what they call an impact multiple of money. So they try and monetize the impact they're having and say, every investment we make has to have at least 2.5 times the impact as we have deployed capital, right? But it's a very rich field and sometimes measurements are good and sometimes they're imperfect. Sometimes you know exactly what you want to drive for and sometimes what really matters you can't measure. Again, how can you measure dignity? But if I were to say, okay, the value of that intervention was this economically and that economically, but if the most important thing to that person was dignity, how do you measure dignity? Mm-hmm. And if we look at things, we did a whole lot of work in government transparency and accountability. I don't know how to measure government transparency. How do you measure? There are some metrics, but it's inherently a little more challenging. Mm-hmm. We're drawn to investing behind the things that are easy to measure, which is fine. But we've also got to look more broadly and look at qualitative measures and be willing to take some risk on things that may be difficult to measure.
Very fascinating. And then seeing that correlation between what I did and what you guys are doing is very interesting. One thing that the Omidyar Network is very unique and pioneering is they allowed an investment mechanism that not only allows for-profit social enterprises, but also not-for-profit social enterprises. You give investments and you give grants. Through this process, what kind of intervention is better through investments and what kind of industry, what kind of problems are better through grants?
It really depends. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so great to have both tools. And by the way, we had within the Omidyar Network, at the individual level, a person could do a grant or an investment. So it's not like you have a grant team and you have an investment team. No, you have a person who's responsible for executing against the strategy. Mm-hmm. And she has grants in her toolkit and she has investments in her toolkit. And she needs to decide. Sometimes if it's an organization that's doing fabulous work, such as Donors Choose, which creates a platform for people to donate to public school projects, they're structured as a not-for-profit. And they need money to help them get to a certain scale, and then they were going to become self-sustaining. So that was obviously going to be a grant because they're structured as a not-for-profit. Other businesses are structured at for-profit, so you can do an investment. And then there are some hybrids where, for example, Bridge Academies received grants, both Bridge Academies and DLIKE, the two examples I cited. They both had grant dollars and investment dollars. And then it depends whether you're providing grant or investment dollars depends upon a whole host of considerations, including, okay, who's providing the capital? So in our case, we provide a lot of grant money, but our investments in Bridge and DLIKE were on the investment side. Although we did a grant to Bridge to do a randomized control trial to try and demonstrate the impact of an education at Bridge. That's an example of where we'll do those. So there are some general rules, but really it's, hey, whatever we find an organization that we believe is going to has a potential for massive impact, we can go either way, depending upon what's most suitable in that occasion. And we ended up roughly doing 50-50, 50% grants and 50% investment.
I see. And that's really a unique way to think about this, because technology and certain companies inside these industries that are fully sustainable can often do a lot of good that private grants sometimes can't reach.
Yeah. The challenge with, so the beauty of not-for-profits is they're completely mission-driven. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They exist to do good, right? And they're tend to be staffed by incredibly dedicated people who basically, in many cases, most cases, have taken, made some financial sacrifices to work in organizations that are committed to social good. Mm-hmm. The challenge with not-for-profits is it's difficult to scale. It's difficult to grow. Yeah. If you have technology, you can grow in a nonlinear fashion, such as donors choose, because every dollar of good they're doing doesn't cost them much incrementally because it's all digital, right? Mm-hmm. However, if you have a great intervention with homelessness or educating disadvantaged populations in the US on a not-for-profit basis, a lot of times, if you want to impact twice as many people, you need twice as many dollars. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's really difficult to raise that money. And a lot of CEOs, chief executives of not-for-profits spend more than half their time trying to raise funds. There's a group, a not-for-profit consulting group called Bridgespan, that looked at a 35-year period beginning in the 70s. They looked at how many not-for-profits have scaled from 0 million to 50 million in revenue. It was about 170. I was curious, and I asked our CFO, how many for-profits scaled from 0 to 50 in that same time period? Tens of thousands. Mm-hmm. It's not that the private sector is better or preferable. It's just easier to get scale. Mm-hmm. And the other interesting thing about the private sector is discipline is imposed in the market. If you're producing a product service that nobody likes, you'll go out of business, right? And the social sector, sometimes there's a disconnect between the people you're giving the product or service to. They're not necessarily paying for it. So how do you understand how they value it? Right. So discipline in the social sector is self-imposed. It actually, in that case, it takes more discipline and a deeper understanding of your customer, because you're not getting the market signals about how much they're going to pay for. Yeah. But so you really need to understand the impact and the impact they perceive, not just this top-down sense of what you think they ought to believe.
Yeah. There's a natural incentive for businesses to earn more money and to grow and to scale. That helps more people. That leads to a virtuous cycle. Where is impact investing headed?
There are a number of things. First of all, I think it's fabulous that people are thinking of a more compassionate capitalism, if you will, that they want their dollars to speak to their values. Mm-hmm. And that they're more and more focused on their investments going towards having an impact. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that continues. And there is a lot of terrific work being done. One of the early questions in impact investing was, can you earn a risk-adjusted return, finding a strong commercial financial return while you're investing for impact? And I think it's generally been proven now that yes, you can. You can, in fact, generate strong commercial returns and also invest for impact. So there's not necessarily a trade-off. The interesting question embedded in that is, if that's true, right? If a given investment that is having impact can generate risk-adjusted returns, then wouldn't capital be going there anyway? What truly incremental value are you creating when you invest in something that you know is going to get risk-adjusted returns and everybody else knows it's going to get risk-adjusted returns? So that's an interesting question that the sector is sorting through. Historically, in a Midyear network, we would say we invested across a continuum of returns. We would invest in stuff that was generating risk-adjusted returns, and we do grants, and we do investments where we expected only return of capital, and then we do everything in between. And we had strict criteria under which we'd invest in different places along the continuum. If you're interested, there's a piece we produced called Across the Returns Continuum. It describes why one would invest in various points in the continuum. A lot of criticism in the early days of impact investing, there was a lot of criticism for people who are willing to subsidize return, we're willing to subsidize impact, because they're saying, okay, you're going to create a bad reputation for impact investing. People think, oh, impact investing is just lazy investing or an excuse for being good, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the pendulum is swinging a little bit back to say, okay, if it proves you can invest for impact and get financial returns, and there's a question of whether you're truly creating something additional, and here's this other space where you might be willing to take more risk, and it truly is going to be incremental because the commercial capital markets are not investing there. So one of the things we, one of the types of investments we got really excited about at the Meteor Network is where we were in a country or a sector where the commercial capital markets didn't appreciate the opportunities there. So a couple of investments we made in Indonesia, handful of investments we made in Africa, where we thought we were going to get really good returns, but nobody else saw it because they weren't actually on the ground building the network, understanding the operators, understanding the market, right? So that's what we get really excited about is the investors who are willing to do that extra work to find those opportunities that can generate strong returns as well as strong impact. So, right, so those are a couple of the, I think, interesting cross-section of impact investing. I have very little doubt that the sector is going to continue to grow because there's the demand. And what I would like to see is more appreciation for the big tent and the different tables under the tent, right? The different tables meaning different players who are looking for different connections between returns, impact, and risk.
So this is a question that ties in both of your experiences. From your backgrounds, both leading eBay and leading the Omidyar Network, do you see the potential of a small startup that you fund through the Omidyar Network doing more good than eBay entering that country? What are the advantages and disadvantages of a startup locally grown versus a large tech company?
Yeah, both really. In some circumstances, getting a company like eBay entering a market with a set of expertise and a global platform is really advantageous. And in some circumstances, you really want to see the local players. It was interesting when I was at eBay International, frankly, there was so much growth. We were so busy with so many different things. We just basically went into the markets with the highest, basically per capita GDP and size of the population. And then for the medium sized market, so to speak, we just figured that rather than going in ourselves, we would, because as a US based company, if you were going to look at Turkey, for example, to float somebody, to plop somebody in from eBay who wasn't Turkish and try and build the eBay of Turkey is not going to be as successful as, or the likely winner is not going to be an executive that eBay plopped into Turkey at that time. It was going to be Turkish entrepreneurs, probably a half a dozen at least, who all had their ideas about how they're going to innovate on a marketplace for Turkey. If you're eBay, you see who emerges as the strongest one, and then you see if there's a partnership available. So there's a lot of cases, or look at, again, the example of Mercado Libre, where we looked at the Latin American market, but those guys had such a talented management team. We're like, boy, we probably, if we wanted to compete against them, first of all, it wouldn't be a priority for us. And second of all, oh my gosh, they're incredibly talented. So why not invest in the local folks rather than believing that somehow we from all the way from San Jose are going to figure out what's right in Buenos Aires or Mexico City or Lima, right?
And the other question is, how can we be a part of this impact investing network?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. There's so many layers to that. So if you have spare cash to invest, if you have any cash to invest in the public markets, first of all, there's a big movement around ESG, environmental, social, and governance. And there are a lot of rating agencies that look at companies that meet certain ESG criteria. So even as a retail investor, you can put your money behind firms that are having a positive social impact. Then there are increasingly also impact funds. Now, most of the impact funds are private equity these days, maybe some venture, but increasingly can invest in funds that have an impact investment orientation. And again, certainly anybody can look at a list of Fortune 500 companies and I'm thinking if they're investing, I'm going to invest in a company that I think is doing more good. I'm not going to invest in tobacco. I'm going to invest in this ed tech company, which is, I look and this ed tech company is disproportionately serving the disadvantaged. I'm going to invest in this ed tech company. So a whole host of ways that one could engage. And then from a career perspective, most of the people we hired at Omidyar Network were people from the investment world, either private equity or VC, and a number of people emerging from who came out of business school. We also hired a lot of people who had, particularly in areas such as governance and citizen engagement, who had more of a not-for-profit background.
This is such a fascinating, unique industry, and it will be so interesting for us to be a part of that.
Absolutely. The crazy thing is I reflect about my career, Christopher, is, and I remember when I was going like in middle school, they said, okay, because my father worked at Boeing for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And that his generation, that's what you did. It was a post-World War II generation. for me, what really worked, again, coming back to a point earlier, was this combination of being, what do I really enjoy? What speaks to me, right? And by the way, it's no, as I was growing up, I loved international affairs. My favorite magazine was always The Economist, which, and so it just totally, and most of my career was on the, has been on the international front. So those are the things that speak to me, but I also got to earn an income. So it's that balance between seeking out that which you love, but also being a little bit pragmatic and saying, okay, I need to earn a little income. Now, some folks are fortunate where they have, they don't, they're modest means, or they don't need to have that much money, and they have a more secure background. And then, so there's a great quote. I think it was John Quincy Adams who said, we study war so that our children can study commerce, so that our grandchildren can study the arts. So the notion is, if you don't mind living very modestly and you have financial security in your background, then that opens up more avenues just to pursue what you truly love. Mm-hmm. But that becomes a stronger, for me, I knew I was going to have to pay my own way through college. I knew now. So there, that pragmatic side had to be a little stronger. My kids are more, a little more able to pursue just what they absolutely love to do. And so that's a consideration, is the pragmatism versus the following what you love. And that balance is something that I'm sure you and the folks listening to us are thinking about pretty deeply.
So at the very end of the interview, what is your final piece of advice for listeners of this podcast?
So I teach MBAs at Stanford. And one of the things I tell them at the end of the conversation, our last class, I talk to them about lessons learned since I was a business school student. Mm-hmm. And then at the very end, I talk to them about the relationship of privilege. Because let's face it, you're a Penn student, right? Penn students, clearly. It's an extraordinary school. It's an extraordinary institution. You're privileged to be there, right? And I tell these business school students, you're privileged to be there. And that's neither good nor bad, right? It is. You're privileged. Mm-hmm. The question is, what is your relationship to that privilege? That's the important question. Because some people might say, look, I was a brilliant student and I got into this great institution. So I've earned it. I've deserved it. It's mine. I'm entitled to my privilege. I've earned it, right? Others may say, hold on. I had some amazing teachers and look what zip code I was born into. And look at what, how good, great care of my parents took for me and the mentors. And maybe my parents and mentors, they helped create this privilege. And maybe they've entrusted something in me. So maybe actually I'm entrusted with my privilege. And that's a very important question. What is your relationship to your privilege? Are you entitled to it, or have you been entrusted with it? And everybody's got to answer that question. But how you answer that question will fundamentally shape your life and shape your career decisions. So I also then I end with a little poem from Tagore, who is a Bengali poet. Three lines, very simple. He said, I dreamt that life was but joy. I awoke to discover that life is but service. I acted and behold, service is joy. That's certainly been part of my journey. The times when I felt most in flow, as they say, is when I felt my work was constructive and helping others, that it was in service to something bigger than myself or even the specific organization I was working for.
That's really beautiful. It's definitely true. I do live in privilege. And with recent current events happening around the world, that point is just ever more important.
And I think with that concludes the interview. But thank you so much.
Absolutely. And when I think about social impact too, I think about investing time with the next generation. It's delightful to spend the time with you. And I wish you and your viewers all the best of luck in your college careers and beyond.
Thank you so much for listening, and make sure to check out more content and subscribe to our podcast.